locomotive, sipping, drinking Arizona. Mixtape just around the corner. Did a lot in California. Can't wait to drop this, don't you? Yeah, they gon' have fun with that. Smash like Songa, man. My songs gon' break through like a running back.
Hello and welcome to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One. My name is Mark Hamilton, and joining me tonight, my friend, my colleague, my neighbor, my frenemy, Mr. Mark Daily. Mark, we are days away from the Monaco GP. Are you excited? We had a weekend off last weekend, unfortunately, of course, because of the circumstances in Northern Italy, but we had a pause. We're back to the grind. One, are you excited? And two, how the heck are you doing?
Before we get started, I wish we were live streaming this tonight, because the look on your face just now when the intro from JT the Human dropped was just priceless. It was just like, we've been doing the show together for how long? A couple of years now, right? And then all of a sudden, it's like you weren't expecting the intro music when every show we've had intro music of some kind or another. But I'm doing good, man. And yeah, honestly, this weekend, Monaco, I'm pretty meh on Monaco. I hate to be a downer right off of the top, because I know for some people they get really stoked and pumped up about Monaco, but I'm not really here for the glitz and glamour. I'm not really here for the yachts or the swimming pools or the A-list celebrities. I'm here for the racing, and Monaco, I mean, it just doesn't cut it in my mind for modern Formula One. The track's too short. It's too narrow. It's too twisty. The cars are too big. They're too wide. They're too everything. And it's basically a rundown to the first corner. And then whoever qualifies in first is typically the person who wins it. But still tune in on Sunday night when we do a recap show, because we will watch the race. We will talk about it, but yeah, it's not really my favorite one, to be quite honest.
Yeah, and you know what? I think it's fair to even just talk about this a little bit. Obviously, we're going to do a race review towards the end of the show, but I think it's fair to open up that dialogue right now that in the past 3 or 4 years, we've been exposed to 30 plus different Formula One Grand Prix circuits because of COVID. We went to places we haven't seen in a long time. We've added a host of new races to the calendar. Obviously, we're going to see Vegas later this season, and we saw Miami last season, and we revisited Turkey for the first time in a long time, and we went to LaSalle and Qatar, and we introduced Jeddah. There's a lot of great Formula One circuit, and there's a lot of really okay Formula One circuit. And then there's Monaco, which is just a terrible Formula One circuit. And I know 2 years ago we sat here, we tried to build it up because a lot of our audience was new and they were seeing it for the first time. And we got a lot of blowback from that. So I think we're being a little bit more honest and a little bit more authentic, but it's not a great race. And I'll be totally honest, the visuals of seeing the yachts in the harbor and the celebrity standing trackside as the checkered flag is waved does absolutely nothing for me. Like, yeah, it looks neat on TV, but if I wanted to see what Monaco looked like, I could Google some photos, or I could ask some friends that have been there. There's a lot of other ways to experience Monaco. And I don't get excited about this race. And I feel like Formula One in so many ways has outgrown it. And maybe for a long time, people would talk about it being the crown jewel of Formula One. And it was so important to the calendar. And it was so important to the calendar that they were basically able to negotiate their contract on their terms. They paid what they wanted to do. They got the date they wanted. They broadcast the race themselves using Tele Monte Carlo, and they basically had a ton of leverage. And I think all of that leverage is now evaporated, and they're paying a hosting fee, and they've lost the broadcast rights to Formula One, who's going to use their global broadcast capabilities. But I wouldn't be crushed. I get that there's some sentimentality because it's been on the calendar consistently since 1950, but I wouldn't be heartbroken if it was gone from the calendar. There aren't many races that are less compelling than this one for me.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of like, in general, it's kind of a cool location. But I mean, we looked at a graphic, I think that you pulled it up, and this must be at least 2 years ago now, Mark, just sort of the evolution of the Formula One car since 1950, since the first time they went to Monte Carlo, the first time they raced around that circuit, and how the cars have evolved in the last was it 75 years or whatever, and how much wider and longer they are, even compared just to like 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago. I mean, the cars have increased dramatically in size just in the past decade. And when you see that, and it was just a real stark, a real wake up call to, well, yeah, I mean, the track is narrow. Even previously, there weren't really a lot of overtaking points as it was, but now the cars have increased so much in size, there just isn't a lot of real estate left on that circuit for these guys to try and get around one another. It really becomes, well, I mean, even strategy doesn't really, I don't know if it's, I mean, strategy is always important, but it seems like the overcut, the undercut, I mean, the whole thing just seems to, it doesn't seem to have as much of an effect here. It really seems to come down to almost luck of the draw that whoever stays out front. I mean, Ricardo won there, what, was it 2018 or 2019? Whatever it was. And what's the problem that he had? Was his MGUK that was failing or something? I mean, he basically had about like 75% of his available horsepower. He still managed to keep that car in front of everybody else for what was it, like 60 laps or something like that to win that race? I mean, I'm not going to throw shade at Danny Ricciardo. I'm not going to take anything away from him because, I mean, you know, that was a superb drive. He did what he needed to do. But I mean, on no other circuit could you be at such a disadvantage compared to all of your other competitors, all the other rivals out there on the track, and be able to have that advantage of just because you're the first car on the track and the track sucks for overtaking, that, you know, the job that you have to defend that lead is just made that much easier, right?
Yeah, I totally agree. The one thing that maybe hasn't changed, and you talk about the transformation of the cars over the years and the decades, the one thing that hasn't changed, though, is that winning here still means a lot more to most of the drivers than winning in most places, that this is something that they savor in a pretty meaningful way. I think the drivers typically keep the trophy so they don't go back to the factories and sit in a glass showcase in the lobby. It means a lot to the drivers, and I think it means a lot to the teams. One other point that I heard on a podcast the other day, and excuse me if I'm wrong, I think it was the Shift F1 podcast, but they made an interesting comment about the fact that Monaco is a real outlier on the calendar in terms of what it demands of the cars. It's very untraditional. It has a different surface. It's very, very tight. It's very narrow. You don't get heat in the brakes the same way that you would in other circuits. You don't get heat in the tire. It's in the way that you do in other circuits. So these cars really aren't optimized for Monaco. And that had never really occurred to me either, that you can't really design a car to function at its optimal capability here because there's no other track like it. So effectively, you develop this car and you design the car for the rest of the calendar because there's a lot of commonality between most other tracks. And this is an outlier. So you get these cars that are unoptimized for the circuit. And generally, they're all unoptimized. So they tend to be kind of competing on even keel. But I'm not excited for this. I'll watch qualifying because qualifying is still a fun shootout. But ultimately, mm-hmm. like you said, and this sounds cliche even saying this because you're going to hear this analysis everywhere, that if you take pole through qualifying, you're very likely going to be in a position where you can win this race. Over the last few years, it's been typically a one-stop race. And the opportunity to displace somebody and pick up a spot in the pecking order is typically through pit strategy. So I think you mentioned that a couple of minutes ago. So that's where places can be won or lost typically, because like you said, they're not going to be picked up through overtakes traditionally, unless somebody makes a mistake and clips a wall, breaks their suspension, runs wide, goes over a curb, and they have to give a place back. Typically, unless there's driver error, you're not going to gain spaces via racecraft and simply outdriving the competitor in front of you.
Well, even if like you're following someone in front of somebody else, whatever the position, you know, whatever track position is, and that car that you're jockeying for positioning goes for their pit stop, before you, you know, it's not like that you can put the hammer down, throw in a couple of smoking fast laps and really open up that, you know, that distance there and try to, you know, nullify the effect that the undercut might have. Or if your rival goes into the pits sooner, they, you try to take advantage of that and go with the overcut. You know, I'm just not convinced that you can really make up that much, you know, take advantage of that one way or another out on the track, just because it, you know, for all the reasons we just discussed in the last 10 minutes or so, there just isn't the space to do so. And yeah, you know, it's just kind of going back to your other point there that, you know, the drivers still seem to really appreciate it. Sure. I mean, yeah, it's got historic value. Many of the drivers live in Monaco, but, you know, the whole sort of, you know, I don't know. There's just something about, like, you know, the whole one percenter thing that just, I don't know, it just doesn't do it for me. And like the spectacle on the track doesn't really do it for me either. So out of like all the other, you know, races on the calendar, this is, like I say, this is the one that I'll kind of go through it because it's a grind. I'm not going to be getting up to watch it like specifically compared to some other races that we have on the calendar. Or it's like, oh, you know, I'm looking forward to Spa, for example, is one of my favorite tracks. Monza is another favorite one. Silverstone, I mean, those are like tracks and races I get really, really excited about. Japan as well, you know, like there's a whole bunch, but it's just like I circle those dates on the calendar, or I guess people don't use calendars anymore, but I set a reminder in my phone. I guess that's more contemporary. You go with the reminder in the phone, because those are races I really look forward to. Whereas Monaco's like, okay, this weekend's Monaco, let's just sit down for the 2 hours and just kind of grind through it, and then it's done for another year. We can go, you know, move on to the next one. But, you know, whatever.
I like your point about the 1% as well. And people listening to this show know I'm a huge pop culture guy. I like my music. I like my movies and my podcast and things like that. But I really don't like when Formula One trots celebrities through the gridwalk and drag them through the paddock. And I despise during a race when they cut to a garage and Tom Cruise is sitting with the Mercedes team with the headphones on, listening to the chatter between the engineer and the drivers. Like, I don't need that. I don't want that. I think F1 is better than that. I think there was a point where it was important to them, to F1. It was important to F1 that they showed celebrities engaging with the sport because it gave them credibility. And I don't think they need that now. And then, of course, Monaco is the ultimate flex and the ultimate kind of drip fest, because you expect people with significant money to be there, and that the harbor's full of yachts does nothing for me. I don't care. I don't care. And I don't want to see Kris Jenner on the camera 74 times towards the end of the race. And I love Justin Bieber. I don't need to see him waving the checkered flag. I don't need to see Gabrielle Union. And these are people I love, Gabrielle Union and Dwayne Wade celebrating. Like, I don't need to see any of this. And I love so many of these people, minus Kris Jenner. But I want the focus to be on the racing and the people within the racing ecosystem. And unfortunately, at Monaco, like the American races in particular, I think the celebrities tend to take away from the people that should be getting all of the exposure and the focus, which is the drivers and the members of the team personnel.
Yeah, I mean, the only time I kind of like those sort of like garage shots and things like that, for example, is that if there's a really cool story out on the track. I mean, this weekend, let's say that Charles Leclerc finally manages to get that monkey off his back and win his hometown race. I mean, he's been really, you know, he's had some pretty bad luck since he's moved to Ferrari. Not, I mean, you could almost apply that at any track that Charles Leclerc has raced at for Ferrari, but the luck has seemed a bit worse in Monaco than anywhere else. So, I mean, if he's got like family or some friends in the Ferrari garage, or there's another great story that there's another young driver, you see their family or whatever.
Family's
it is.
Different,
that,
man.
That's
family's
different, right?
Different.
Exactly.
Family's different.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I would, because that's a cool story to see, because they've put so much aside to help this, the driver and their career and everything, to see that person do well and see their family kind of living that moment with them. That's cool. That there's a real emotion there. You know, you could get excited about that, and you know, that's kind of cool. So anyways, we kind of jumped into it a little bit earlier than usual. And there are lots of really cool things to talk about this week. So we're going to kick off a couple of them, go into break, keep going, because there's plenty to do before we even preview the race itself. But before you do that, just want to give a shout out to the Race Weekend magazine. You can head on over to theraceweekend.com. That is RACEWKND.com. Enter in our promo code ScuderiaPod at checkout. Save 10%. You can also head on over to RacingExclusives.com. Tease has presented us with a wonderful bunch of swag and a signed half-scale Max Verstappen helmet for the winner of our Fantasy League this year. So go and check them out, RacingExclusives.com. They got tons of great things in the store there, and they all come with a certificate of authenticity. Now, I know you should. We'll probably want to take this one because our good friend Andy Amendola has got something going on with Red Racer Books. So let's hear what Andy's got going on.
Yeah, Andy, man, this guy is grinding out there, producing some really great original world class.
Putting in the work.
Yeah, man, some really great world class Formula One related merchandise. And obviously, you've heard us talk at length about the books that he's produced. My son has both of them. We spent many, many hours reviewing them, but he's got some really cool stuff brewing up for Father's Day. So I'm just reading here from the website. They've developed a Father's Day Grand Prix bundle. And the bundles, which include free shipping, are very, very cool. So let me bring up the first one so I can describe the contents. So the first one is a bundle that includes one ABCs of racing hardcover book from Red Racer Books, which you've heard us speak a lot about, but it also includes a new gizmo, a new gadget, a new tool. It includes one Grand Prix specialty racing set from Way to Play Cars. And this is basically a racetrack that your kids can piece together almost like it's giant pieces of Lego. So if you've got some model cars at home, if you've got some Hot Wheels, if you've got some 1/18 scale cars, you can break them out and play. Very, very cool. So the bundle includes one hardcover copy of ABCs of Racing, and it includes a Grand Prix specialty racing set from Way to Play Cars. Included within that, flexible and durable toy circuit, 16 curves and 8 straight, special Grand Prix prints can be used inside or outside. Encourages imaginative play, great to combine with other toys. They have another bundle here, which includes the same. I'll bring this up real quick just so I can make sure we read it. It includes two books, one ABCs of Racing hardcover, one all about race cars, and one F1 circuit Zandvoort specialty racing set from Way to Play Cars. So you can actually build the Zandvoort circuit, which I think you would be pretty excited about. Right now, they're both on sale. So the first bundle, which includes a single book, going for $118. And if you're interested in the other, which includes two hardcover books and the Zandvoort F1 circuit in the premium bundle, that's going for $201. So some very, very cool stuff there. And again, if you're looking for a gift for a father that will allow them to share their passion for racing with their kids, I think this is a really great place to start.
Very cool. Love all the stuff that Andy's been doing over the last couple of years. Hey, Mark, why don't we jump into a break now a little bit ahead of schedule, because we can come back, because we're going to talk about this Honda-Aston Martin partnership, and that's going to take up a lot of discussion. This is really, really huge news, so we'll do that in just a moment. So don't go away. We will be back after a very brief word from our sponsors.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
5103 declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. So, yes, huge news that we just talked about before the break. Honda is set to return to Formula One in 2026 as the engine supplier for Aston Martin. This is huge, huge, huge news. And Mark, when I heard this story break earlier this week, I just kind of went through that whole sort of repeating endless circle. It's like, is Honda here? Are they gone? Like, what is the deal with Honda? Because they were in Formula One, then they quit, but they're not really gone because they're still supplying power units to Red Bull. But, you know, it's all been kind of confusing. But the whole point is that, you know, they're still in Formula One right now. They've won a number of championships with Red Bull, and Red Bull's decided, obviously, to start up their own thing with Red Bull powertrains. And they have an agreement with Honda to keep using the Honda power unit for a couple of years yet. But then Aston Martin splitting off, moving away from Mercedes and taking on these Honda power units. Boy, this is big, Mark. And it really, when I heard this, I was just like, wow. Aston Martin, they're here and they really mean business. I think this is an exciting time to be around this team. I mean, they've had a very good start to the season this year. Fernando Alonso is driving like 21-year-old Fernando, not like 41-year-old Fernando. I think there's a lot of things going well for this team right now, not to mention the new factory. This engine deal, I think, is just massive for not only for Aston Martin, for Honda, but Formula One as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more with everything you said. And I have to give credit where credit's due, that I think Aston Martin Performance CEO Martin Whitmarsh was a big part of brokering this deal. And if you know me, I've been a big critic of Martin Whitmarsh for a very, very long time. But interestingly, he was also the person that brokered the deal to bring Honda to McLaren back in 2015. That deal was sealed in 2013. So here he is now, many years later, 10 years later in 2023, brokering a very, very similar deal with Aston Martin. And this is both a significant deal for Aston Martin, but perhaps an even more significant deal for Formula One as a whole. And when I talk about it being a significant deal for Aston Martin, and a lot of these points are going to sound familiar because you and I have talked about them so much over the past few weeks, that as we understand it, and based on some quotes coming out of the Honda camp, as it stands right now, this is an exclusive arrangement that Honda will be supplying power units to one team and one team only, which is Aston Martin. So the two teams will be able to begin work on that 2026 power unit effective immediately. And we should clarify as well that while ultimately Aston Martin is going to divorce their technical relationship from Mercedes, they'll continue to partner with them through the end of 2025. So this new power unit arrangement doesn't go into effect until 2026 when the new 2026 power units come into effect. So in the meantime, Honda as a contractor is going to continue to supply the current spec engines to Red Bull and AlphaTauri, but simultaneously, they are going to start developing the 2026 power unit in collaboration with Aston Martin. And this is really powerful because it effectively makes Aston Martin a works team in the sense that they will now collaboratively have control over the design and the build of the entire car from the chassis to the engine. Now, it also means that they have to be pretty ambitious because as a Mercedes technical partner today, they don't just buy the engines, they're also buying the gearbox. And in this new arrangement with Honda, Honda's going to supply the power unit, but now Aston Martin is going to have to start developing parts that they would otherwise be buying from Mercedes, including the gearbox. box and a lot of the other packaging materials and components that go into putting that power unit into the chassis. So I think this is huge for Aston Martin. I think it's a coup for Martin Whitmarsh. I think it's a coup for Lawrence Stroll that ultimately he wanted to have a championship caliber Formula One team. And he's building it in such a manner that I can't help but think that they're going to arrive at that destination sooner rather than later. And I think when I said this was huge for Formula One, we're talking about a sport that's going to have six engine manufacturers in 2026. Six. The last time we had six, you had to go back to 2007 and 2008 when we had the likes of Toyota and BMW and some other teams on the grid. That this is huge. And really, it just speaks to the fact that one, the sport's incredibly attractive, that you can bring six power unit manufacturers onto the grid, possibly seven if Cadillac can and Andretti Motorsport can kind of get their package together and get onto the grid. But right now you have six, which is a huge win for this team, because from a marketing perspective, they're winning and they're winning in a pretty significant way. I think one of the big takeaways from the last couple of days is Honda wanted to return for a number of reasons. And one of them was that the 2026 power units are far more compatible with their vision and their aim for their road car divisions than the current spec power units. That if we had largely carried over the current spec hybrid power units to 2026, I don't think Honda would have entertained the idea of returning. Of course, as we know, they're going to be far more electrical based in terms of how much of the power is generated from the electrical system. They're going to have synthetic fuels, all these kind of things. But the other big thing that made this attractive to Honda is you and I have talked so much about the cost cap, $140 million a year, $135 million, $130 million a year. Teams can breach the cost cap. There's a penalty, but ultimately it's designed to drive competitive parity. Starting this year, and this is something that we don't talk a lot about and isn't broadly understood, there is also a separate cost cap for power units. So Mercedes, Ferrari, Honda, Red Bull, Ford powertrains, etc., they have to adhere to a cost cap for their engine development. So in 2023, 2024, and 2025, those teams are allowed to commit only $95 million a year to develop the 2026 spec power units. Now in 26, 27, 28, 29, and 30, they're allowed to spend $130 million a year designing and enhancing and developing that power unit. But just as the cost cap lends cost certainty to teams that want to join the grid and to existing teams, the fact that there's now a cost cap on the development of this new 2026 power unit lent a lot of, I would say, comfort to Honda, that they know that coming in, our maximum financial outlay per year for the next 3 years is going to be $95 million. 95 this year, next year, the year after. So they know that Ferrari is only spending 95, Red Bull Ford powertrains is only spending 95, Mercedes is only spending 95, Renault. So it lends some comfort there. But ultimately, this is huge. I'm incredibly excited. I'm so happy that they're on the grid. And it's funny because, Mark, one of the very first podcasts that you and I did together was back at the end of 2020. And we were talking about how Ford had announced they were exiting the sport after 21. And of course, they went on to win the Drivers' Championship that year. They won two championships the year after, and they're going to win two championships this year. So they've had a phenomenal run with Red Bull. And I see no reason why that run can't continue with their new partner in Aston Martin.
Exactly. And Mark, I just wanted to read a couple of quotes here in an article from BBC chief F1 writer Andrew Benson. And he's got a couple of really interesting quotes here. The first one is from Honda Racing Corporation president Koji Watanabe. And the quote is as follows, quote, "In pursuit of its goal of in achieving carbon neutrality by 2030, starting in the 2026 season, the FIA will mandate the use of 100% carbon neutral fuel, and the deployment of electrical power will be increased significantly by three times from current regulations. With this massive increase in electrical power, the key to winning in F1 will be a compact, lightweight, and high-power motor with a high-performance battery that is capable of swiftly handling high power output, as well as the energy management technology. We believe this know-how gained from this new challenge has the potential to be applied directly to a future mass production electrical vehicle. End quote. And then Watanabe also goes on to talk about the removal of the MGUH, which is the part of the hybrid system in the current power units. And, we've talked about this quite a bit. Anyways, Watanabe had to say about the MGU and its removal as follows, quote, currently the electrical power accounts for 20% or less compared to the internal combustion engine. But the new regulations require about 50% or more of electrification, which moves even further towards electrification. I believe the technology for electrification will be useful for us in producing vehicles in the future. End quote. So there you go. And that was a big thing, because when they announced a couple of years ago that they were going to leave the sport at the end of 2021, that the whole idea for Honda was to focus all their resources solely on the electrification of their road cars. So that, this really is a fascinating development, that the way that these new engine regs for 2026 are so attractive for Honda, not just to come back into Formula One, but they see a direct tie-in to what they can develop and build that will, I think when Watanabe says that they see a real potential for a mass-produced electric vehicle, which I think is really exciting. Also, a couple other quotes here from Martin Whitmarsh, who you mentioned, and Martin is the CEO for Aston Martin Performance Technologies, and he had the following to say, quote, Aston Martin is building a team to win in F1. We have been recruiting the right people and investing in the required facilities and developing the right culture and processes to win. To partner a global motorsport titan like Honda is an extremely exciting and important further step for the team. Both organizations share the same relentless ambition to succeed on track. We are very proud, honored, and grateful to put in place this partnership. Anyways, Whitmarsh also goes on to say, quote, it is very clear from what we've seen with Honda and our recent learnings that they have a huge passion. They want to win. This is what they want to do, and that is our goal. We are already confident that this is going to be a fantastic partnership for the future, end quote. And, there's a number of things here, where Martin just mentions, he says, investing in the required facilities. And I think that's a key takeaway that, maybe needs to be, just brought a little bit more into light, because if this was just the rebranded Racing Point team, which was just a rebrand from, Force India, in that same tiny out-of-date facility at Silverstone, I'd be like, yeah, I don't really believe that, there's anything behind this. But, Aston Martin and, they've been building a state-of-the-art new campus, new facility. Are they in there, or is it still in
later
its final
this
stages
year.
Of construction?
We've been saying that for 5 years, but later this year.
I feel like that, yeah, because I think they pushed that that date back at least
couple
of times.
COVID caused some havoc with the timelines.
Yeah, but I mean, they are going to shortly move into a state-of-the-art facility. And of course, like when you say that, not only are they currently buying the power unit and other sundries, for example, like the gearbox from Mercedes, I'd be really skeptical whether or not they'd be able to pull off like the design of like and build of something as important as a gearbox in their current facilities. But now that they are poised to move into something state-of-the-art, something modern, something significantly bigger, they've got a growing workforce that I'm about as confident as I can be looking from the outside in and, this being a team that I'm really excited to see grow and hopefully win in the future. I'm about as confident as I could be, because they're doing everything, let's just say, on the outside, they appear to be doing everything correctly. Now, whether or not they put all the pieces in the right place and they've done everything right, we will see that proven over the years ahead. But certainly to partner with somebody like Honda, who are just hitting ball after ball out of the park, it's just constant home runs with Honda the last couple of years, you got to be very excited. Okay, this is what they're doing right now. And as you said, they can effectively start working now on designing things and working together for the future, because that was a big thing that when they partnered with Red Bull now several years ago, was before when Red Bull they were just basically trying to marry the old Renault engine into the car. But once they divorced themselves from Renault, connected with Honda, and there was this real, you know, teamwork that they were working on, you know, building the car and the engine together. So it was a lot more compatible rather than Honda saying, here, guys, here's a power unit. You guys figure out how you're going to put it into the car. So the fact that, you know, there was that real teamwork, attitude, I'm sure that Honda's going to take that forward with them. And the fact that they got like literally years to start working together is just, I think if you're an Aston Martin fan, I think you got to be very, very excited about this prospect.
There's another great quote here from Koji Watanabe from the Honda team. He says, in October of 2020, we announced the withdrawal from the F1. So we ended the F1 activities at the end of the 2021 season. But until March of 2022, we have been fully engaged in development of the power units for up until 2022. We had the full head count still remaining until this time. So the development numbers or the development members were still existing until March of 2022. However, then they were allocated to different carbon neutral projects. So the head count of the development members started to decrease starting from April of 2022. However, in April of 2022, a new company called Honda Racing Corporation, HRC, was established. This is the dedicated company for motorsport races. So this company kept on engaging in the studies and development of four-wheel technology. We have commenced studies regarding the new regulations. So therefore, we don't think we have lost so much regardless of our withdrawal from F1 race at one point in time. And this is important because you and I have talked a lot about the fact that there are other teams in Formula One that already have single cylinder internal combustion engines that mirror the 2026 power unit engine specifications on the test bench, that these teams are actively, we know Red Bull Ford powertrains, Mercedes, Renault, Ferrari, we all know that they're fairly advanced in their development of the power unit. And the reason that this is a reassuring comment from Koji is the fact that I was worried that while they were idly sitting on the sidelines, these other teams were shifting ahead with their development and they could be falling behind. And the reason this comment's relevant is if you remember, Honda most recently rejoined F1 in 2015. That was a year into the turbo hybrid era. So they started that journey a year after the other teams. And by the time they had an engine ready for McLaren, Renault, Mercedes, Ferrari, etc., they already had an entire campaign of data to push the development of their engines forward. So Honda was already at a hugely significant disadvantage. The other thing that I think is worth calling to attention here is as bad as the performance and reliability of that Honda power unit was in 2015, McLaren really had cuffed Honda's ability to innovate and develop that power unit themselves. They had imposed some very strict restrictions on the packaging, the weight, the dimensions of that power unit. And I think once they were unhandcuffed from McLaren and McLaren's onerous demands on the power unit, and they were able to develop more freely once they got to a good place with Red Bull, they obviously flourished. So I think there's a lot to learn from the discord that arose from their relationship with McLaren, but I think this is such a good thing. And you know, Mark, over the last couple of years, I sat here and I criticized Lawrence Stroll for hiring Martin Whitmarsh, and I criticized them for hiring Mike Krack. I criticized them for dispensing seemingly of Otmar, all these different decisions. But as we sit here now and the team's on the verge of opening a new factory and on the verge of becoming a works team in a partnership with Honda, and as they sit second in the championship and Fernando Alonso has four podiums through five Grand Prix, everything seems to be coming up Aston Martin. And I think it's an exciting time to be a Formula One fan for, if no other reason than simply because we've seen a rejuvenation of the Aston Martin brand on the Formula One grid.
Oh yeah, I mean it's such a great brand. Their marketability, that's a difficult word late on a Thursday night to try and spit out. Anyways, it's a great brand to try and market. I mean, it's just got such an appeal to it. And if they can get a car, get a team that is really, you know, at the front of Formula One, I think that it'll really take off. I think it'll really capture people's imaginations. But I just wanted to back things up for a second. You raised raised such a good point that when Honda came back into the Formula One in 2015 with McLaren, yeah, they were a year behind everyone else, but it seemed like the gap between Honda compared to Ferrari, Mercedes, and Renault, the other three engine manufacturers at the time, it seemed like it was so much more. I mean, to say that they were behind the development curve compared to those other three, I mean, I think it's a bit of an understatement because they were really, 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 you know, disadvantaged. I mean, McLaren, that is, with that Honda power at that time, for the reasons that you correctly laid out. I mean, to the point that when Red Bull was looking at it a couple of years down the road, when they had you know, Hondas in the, which would have been Toro Rosso at the time, or AlphaTauri now, were basically comparing the numbers they're getting from the Renault engines in their own cars compared to the Honda engines in the Toro Rosso's. I was kind of wondering, I had a lot of question marks at the time. It's like, you know, is this a right move? Is this a wise move for Red Bull? But I mean, it was a bit of a masterstroke by them because, I mean, they literally were able to try before they buy, right? And see the numbers that were coming out from both power units. I mean, obviously the rest of that story is, you know, kind of writes itself with the success that they had, because I mean, when they switched over initially, Honda said that the goal, the benchmark, was to deliver performance that was on par with the results that they were getting with Renault, which is by and large what they got that first season. But things very quickly accelerated, you know, after that. I mean, the pandemic disruption notwithstanding. I mean, once they got everything all figured out and they got everything all lined up, I mean, that program really took off. But it was a pretty rocky reintroduction, relaunch into Formula One. But it was exciting times. But The next thing I want to talk about is obviously Honda, Japanese manufacturer. We have one Japanese driver in Formula One at the moment, that is AlphaTauri's Yuki Tsunoda. And, you know, there is some speculation that, you know, what with Honda committing long-term to Formula One, that they would love to see a Japanese driver in one of those cars with the benefit of having Japanese power, hopefully, you know, propelling that driver to wins and possibly a championship. The big question is, I mean, sure, I understand that. That makes sense. I mean, you would love, you know, everybody loves to cheer for the hometown team, right? And if you're Honda, and I mean, Japan is, I mean, there's, you know, such a culture that loves racing. I mean, they love Formula One. We see it all the time when we go to Suzuka every year for the Japanese Grand Prix. So you can see that would be a logical talking point that would come up. I mean, the thing is, I mean, I love Yuki. I mean, his great personality, probably, you know, for the wrong reasons. But, you know, if he was to be that person, that driver that they want to see, Honda, that is, in an Aston Martin and hopefully winning races and potentially championships, I think Yuki Tsunoda's got a lot of maturing to do both in and out of a Formula One car. Hammy, your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't disagree, and I apologize for the pause there as I collected my thoughts, but there was a general acknowledgement from Honda this week that they will not have direct influence over who's going to be in these cars. And oftentimes in a works arrangement, the power unit supplier will actually have some input. Now, if you flash back to the late 2000s when Mercedes was supplying McLaren in an exclusive deal, I think one of the things that caused a lot of discord in that relationship was that they didn't have any input. And I think there's a general acknowledgement here that Honda, as the relationship, the agreement currently stands, won't have any influence, but they'll certainly be able to share their input. And it only makes sense that they would acknowledge and promote the idea of potentially having a Japanese driver in one of the two Aston Martins come 2026. And obviously, like you said, there's a Japanese driver on the grid today in Yuki Tsunoda. He's a couple of years into his career with AlphaTauri. I think off the track, he's probably developed a little bit versus where he was during his initial campaign, where he seemed woefully unprepared for the rigor and the demands and the requirements of being a Formula One driver. And we saw glimpses of that, of course, in Netflix's Drive to Survive, where he simply didn't want to commit to a workout routine. But I think he's developed and he's managed to claw his way into the points a few times this year with a car that probably doesn't deserve to be there. But again, if I'm Honda and I'm kind of committing to this works program with Aston Martin, sure, I for the sake of marketability, like you said a couple of minutes ago, love to have a Japanese driver. But I think what's more important than having a Japanese driver for Honda is simply having the best possible drivers, because what's more important than having a Japanese driver in a car powered by a Honda power unit that's being shipped to Silverstone from Tokyo, what's more important than having a Japanese driver? Winning championships. And I think that's going to take precedence over everything else. But I did think it was interesting, and I can't find the exact quote now, but it was a general acknowledgement from Watanabe that while they won't be able to specifically dictate or influence the decision, they'll certainly be able to give feedback and recommendations as to who should be in that car. Interestingly, please go on. Yeah.
I was just going to say, I do have that quote from Koji Watanabe here, and it is as follows, quote, "We have been accelerating out development during our recent time in Formula One while working with Alonso, and that has enabled us to win the world championship. The selection of drivers is up to the team to decide, so if the team decides we'll have Alonso as a driver again, we will have no objections whatsoever in him driving," end quote. So Martin Whitmarsh also has a couple of things to say on that. He says, quote, "Clearly, Fernando's doing a great job in the team, and I'm delighted to have him as part of our team, as he's making a great contribution both on and off the track. Obviously, I spoke to Fernando a while ago about the direction we wanted to go. He's a very intelligent individual. I'm sure everyone here is referring to some comments that were made in the heat of a battle once, which were quite memorable for some, GP2. But I think he understands.
GP2.
Yeah, the GP2, yeah, and respects what Honda is doing. We've got to be aware, and we haven't said that, but we should say it. Honda won the 2021 and 2022 World Championships, and unless we can beat them this year, they're going to do it again. So they are a great partner for us, and I think Fernando sees that. Probably 2026, who knows? It's probably outside his planning horizon at the moment. We've got to give him a car that is consistently capable of winning races, and as I hope you've observed, we've made a reasonable step forward this year. We're not going to get to where we need to be, but we're continuing to develop the team's facilities and we'll get stronger," end quote. And that's from an article from Lawrence Barreto on Formula1.com. But Mark, you just mentioned it with what Martin was referring to, the famous comments that were made in the heat of the battle was back when he was driving for McLaren from 2015 to 2017, and he called the Honda engine a GP2 engine when at the Japanese Grand Prix.
GP2 at the
year.
Time, I mean, was a Formula One feeder series, so it was a massive insult that was not well received in Tokyo by any means.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was about sort of the peak of grumpy Fernando. There's a lot of choice, at very unflattering things that he said on the radio, many, many times during that era. But yeah, very, very exciting to see. So, Mark, let's take another quick break here. We'll come back. Got a couple of fun stories to talk about. And the first one we'll talk about is how racing drivers blink when they're driving their cars around a racetrack. So we'll do that in a moment. So don't go away. We'll be back on the flip side. All right. Welcome back. So this is an interesting one that you pulled up for the show outline, and this is an article that is on newscientist.com. This is probably the first and only time that we will go to a website and a publication like newscientist.com for a Formula One story. But this is a story that's written by Soumya Sagar, and it's called "Racing Drivers Blink at the Same Points When Going Around a Track." And then the byline goes on to say, "Synchronized blinking may reflect a certain cognitive state that professional racers have when controlling a fast-moving car." So this is very interesting. So I'll just read from this article from Soumya. And it says here, "Different racing drivers blink at around the same points in a circuit, which could reflect their synchronized mental states as they concentrate on controlling the car. Blinking lubricates our eyes, but how it links to other aspects of our health are unclear. Studying this further could help us better understand conditions where blinking rates change, such as Parkinson's disease. We generally blink about 12 times per minute, with each blink lasting about 1/3 of a second. Our blinking rate has been linked to the attention we give a certain task, with some people blinking less when they concentrate on a screen. Many people think that blinking is done solely to moisten the eyes, but only a few blinks per minute suffice for this purpose, says Ryota Nishizono at NTT Communication Science Laboratories in Atsugi, Japan. To study how driving could influence blinking, Nishizono and his colleagues looked at three professional male drivers working for a Formula racing team. The drivers carried out 304 practice laps of three circuits in Japan, Fuji, Suzuka, and Sugo. A binocular eye tracker mounted on their helmets recorded their blinking, counted by machine learning. An analysis of the data revealed that, although the blinking frequency of the drivers differed, they generally blinked around the same points on each circuit, with their rate of blinking decreasing as they drove faster. End quote. Now, that is absolutely fascinating. Number one, I'd like to know who came up with it, with the idea to do this in the first place. But it's very interesting how they found that the drivers have this sort of synchronized blinking when they would get to certain parts of the track, because they're all going to try to hit the same entry points for the corner, try to hit the same apex of the quarter, try and get the fastest line around the track. So there's obviously some underlying mental process that in the brain of all these drivers, and perhaps all of us, that is being reflected in this physical reaction in the eye blinking. But to see that it would happen at roughly the same time, I wonder if it sort of precedes some sort of, more physical exertion when they throw the car into a turn or something like that. This is very, very interesting, Mark. I don't know where you found this story, but I wish it's very short. I mean, I read the entire article there at about 15, 20 seconds or whatever it was, but I'd love to know, if they could really dig deeper into this, what are the implications of this? Because obviously there's got to be more to it than just, they just all happen to blink at the same time at the same points on the track and that's it. What is the deeper story to this? Very, very cool stuff.
Mark, this article was far too complex for me. So I had sent you the link in the hopes that you would be able to break it down in a manner that I was better able to understand. So congratulations, mission accomplished. Thank you. Thank you. And I found it. And I take no credit. I'm not typically reading newscientist.com. I found it on Reddit.
There you go. Well, wherever you found it, it was a very cool one to throw into the show outline for this week. Anyways, the next story I wanted to talk about, and you'd mentioned this a little bit earlier, like off the top of the show when we were talking about, some of the not very nice things we said about the Monaco Grand Prix. But one thing you did mention about is that they typically would wrestle the television broadcast away from Formula One, but apparently Formula One has wrested control back away from the local people, and they're going to be doing that for this week, and they're going to be broadcasting the Monaco Grand Prix on their own for the very first time. So this means now that Formula One is in charge of operations at races across the entire calendar. So, Mark, why don't you tell us a little bit more about this one?
Yeah, and I'll kind of get through this one pretty quickly because we've still got some other great stuff to talk about. But the main point here being that the Monaco race organizers have historically been able to dictate that their production team broadcast the race. So they would use their own television cameras and they would use their own production crew and their own, most importantly, directors to put together the feed. And then Formula One, Sky, et cetera, would just pick up the feed and throw their own broadcast race analysis on top of it. They've not historically done a very good job, to be totally honest. And I think criticism peaked in 2000 when there was a brewing battle on track between Sebastian Vettel and Pierre Gasly. And just as Vettel was emerging from the pits and was about to go head to head with Gasly in a very, very, very tasty little battle, the TV feed cut away, and I'm referencing racingnews365.com, the TV feed cut away to a replay of Lance Stroll making a mistake and cutting a chicane, missing what everyone wanted to see, which was the battle between Pierre Gasly and Sebastian Vettel. So if that wasn't the final nail in the coffin, I'm not totally sure what was, but it just means now that Formula One will use their own cameras, their own production team, and most importantly, their own race directors. And the race directors are the individuals that sit, have all of the different feeds in front of them, and they're the ones that are picking and choosing what we see at home on the global feeds. So it should be an improved experience this year. Obviously, the window dressing, which would be the Sky Sports broadcast packaging and logos and emblems, that was always there. But the actual race direction should be better this year.
Yeah, cool. Looking forward to that. Sticking with Monaco, McLaren is going to run a one-off Triple Crown livery at Monaco to celebrate their 60th anniversary. So they're going to have papaya at the back, white in the middle, and black livery on the front. So obviously the cars, they're driven this year by Lando Norris and Piastri. So there's a reason that they chose these three colors. So the papaya at the back is to celebrate McLaren's maiden win at the Indy 500 that was driven by Johnny Rutherford way back in 1974. And then in the middle of the car, they have what they call Sharp Ice White, which is in recognition of Frenchman Alain Prost's 1984 Monaco Grand Prix win. And that is really sort of iconic of that that era of McLaren cars that had the red and white color scheme from the mid-80s to the early 90s, obviously more synonymous with a certain cigarette brand until they switched to silver in the early 2000s, which was also, you know, congruent with another cigarette brand. Anyways, finally on the front of the car, they're going to have black, which is a tribute to the McLaren F1 GTR that won the 1995 Le Mans 24 Hours. And that was a car that was driven by JJ Lehto, Yannick Dalmas, and Masanori Sakaya, and that was McLaren's first shot at Le Mans. So very, very cool. You know, I like the idea of teams and drivers being able to do some of these special liveries. We saw last year Lando and Danny Ricciardo having those really cool kind of throwback retro helmets for Monaco, and we've seen teams do things like this before. And I'm all for it. I think it looks pretty good. You know, sadly the car itself isn't the greatest this year, but certainly a cool idea for McLaren to do that. Okay, moving to the next one. So Mercedes are predicting a 0.2 second game in time from the new direction that they're going in with the W14 and the new upgrade package that's coming on
daily,
the car.
Daily, the zero pods are gone. Can you believe it?
That's, really kind of shocking considering that they've stuck with it for so long. And obviously it was a concept that wasn't working, because as we just talked about even last week or the week before on the podcast, where we said that if that zero side pod concept was something that that was good, that was going to be something, then everybody else would have caught on to it. Everybody would have copied it. But the fact that nobody didn't, and Mercedes stuck with it for as long as they could, that they have until now, is quite extraordinary. But glad to see that they've moved away from that. Anyways, Mercedes race engineer Andrew Shovlin said earlier this year, quote, "At the time, we made some decisions how to develop the W14, how it works aerodynamically, and how to design some of its features differently." So obviously that they put some thought into this. But Mark, okay, what other things are we looking at then, in addition to the disappearance of the zero side pod concept?
So here's what we know. So we're sitting here recording on Thursday, May 25th. It's about 10:30 p.m. Pacific time. So we haven't yet seen the cars on the grid, but a number of sleuth photographers and people in attendance at the race in Monaco have been able to snag some photos of the Mercedes W14s being assembled in the garage. And there are a couple of things that do stick out. One is the fact that the side pods have been transformed. Now, they are not Red Bull specific side pods. They are not Aston Martin side pods, but they are far more similar to what Red Bull and Aston Martin are rocking than certainly what was on this car the last time we competed in a Formula One Grand Prix. So a couple of things, the zero pod design has been smoothed out. It is gone. And it appears that we're moving from a very awkward, tight vertical inlet to more of a horizontal inlet. Now, it's speculated amongst the analysts and folks in the media that ultimately this still isn't the side pod that Mercedes wanted, but that they're ultimately significantly limited by the packaging of the power unit in the cooling system and the side impact structures, that ultimately the side pods that they probably wanted to develop are something we're not going to see until they have a new chassis on the W50 next year. But ultimately, it's a pretty significant change. Two other big things that we expect to see this weekend. One is a new floor, which is not insignificant. And typically when you make an aerodynamic change as significant as changing the side pods on the upper surface of the car, there's a knock-on effect, and that resulted in some other aerodynamic tweaks and modifications, including a new floor. And the other big thing, and there's some really great photos, and I'm probably not best equipped to talk about the advantages of this design yet, but they have a fundamentally new front suspension, which has much more in common with the AMR 23 and the current generation Red Bull than the Mercedes that we last saw on the track. So these are not insignificant updates when you're talking about reevaluating the entire aerodynamic surfaces of your side pods and the floor. And of course, in past years, the floor may not have been so critical, but given the fact that you're generating downforce from it, there's absolutely some opportunity to gain some performance. Now, the key is there's probably not a lot we're going to be able to take away from this upgrade this weekend, simply because, like you described so eloquently earlier, this isn't a particularly racy track. Now, it will be interesting to see what times look like in qualifying, but ultimately it's still going to take Mercedes some time to better understand the setup that they're going to need, camber, and obviously all the other things that go into setting up a car for a Formula One Grand Prix. So this is their first race with it. We should have a much better understanding of the impact of these upgrades come Spain the following weekend.
Yeah, exactly. When we see the car on a proper Formula One track. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see. But I was just checking also when you're saying that the cars haven't taken to the track yet. I was just checking on the official Formula One website. So we're now less than 6 hours away from the first practice session at Monaco as we sit here record at 10:30 p.m. on Thursday night here on the West Coast. Now, before we get into this next story from Sam Cooper on planetf1.com, I think we have to preface this with, this has to be the story of the week that made the least sense. And I think that Sam's article kind of nicely elaborates on that. And this was this rumor that came out last weekend, in and around the canceled Imola Grand Prix, and that was the rumor that perhaps Lewis Hamilton was going to make a switch to Ferrari. When I first heard those rumors, my initial thought was, why? Like, why would Lewis even contemplate that? He's got his 7 chips. He's at Mercedes. He's at a team that's all about him, and he's all about them. They got a great relationship together. And it, like, what's Lewis now, 38 years old? I mean, he's not old, but I mean, it's just like, would you really want to go from a well-oiled machine like Mercedes? And even though that, they haven't been performing at what we've been used to over the past 2 years compared to the previous, 7 or 8? I mean, this is still Mercedes. I mean, we just literally got finished talking about how they've moved away from this design concept that they've had for the past 18 months, and they're going to a different design concept. Lewis said in the meantime that he's close to signing a new deal with them, and the current performance of the car over this year and last year had nothing to do with his decision. But I mean, why would he, at the age that he's at and everything that he's achieved with, in Formula One with Mercedes, why would he want to leave such a good place like Mercedes and go to a team like Ferrari that, at least on the outside, seems a lot more chaotic and less well organized, and they've obviously got their challenges, and this seems to be a bit of a perpetual Ferrari story. I mean, maybe Frédéric Vasseur is the person that can go in there and sort them out and get them organized and get them focused, but we've probably said that about the last several team principals at Ferrari. I don't know, Mark. I thought this was just a bit of a strange story, and I think that Lewis even made the quip earlier this week that I guess that nobody had anything else to talk about with the cancellation of the Grand Prix last weekend, so just talking about something was better than talking about nothing, and I tend to agree with him. I mean, I see very little logic in Lewis switching to Ferrari. Yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts now that I've rambled a bit.
It's totally illogical, and I think I know Lewis addressed this during media availability today in Monaco when he said, I think naturally when you're in contract negotiations, there's always going to be speculation. I think ultimately, unless you hear from me, then that's all it is. And furthermore, he indicated that a renewed contract is quote unquote nearly there, and then further reinforce that there's been no contact with Ferrari whatsoever. And of course, this week, Ferrari also denied that there had been conversations with Lewis Hamilton. One of the things that I did think was very interesting, and I don't have the quote in front of me, but where Lewis made these comments, I think naturally when your contract locations, et cetera, at this media availability, he did further continue on that it was a very specific person in that room of reporters that had published the story that I think has been largely debunked since that time. So I thought it was interesting that he specifically called out that individual, not by name, but acknowledged that that person was in the room. And I think that's good because obviously F1 Reddit and F1 Twitter exploded earlier this week with this kind of understanding, this impression, this idea that this could be a real world move. And I cannot think for the life of me what it would be that Ferrari could offer to entice Lewis to that organization, especially at this point in his career. And you and I have spoken so much about the fact that Lewis possibly has the leverage and the ability to negotiate almost any salary that he wants. But furthermore, if I'm a part of the Ferrari team and I help deliver six world drivers' championships to this team, at this point, I'm negotiating for equity in the team. Toto Wolff owns a third of the team. Mercedes AMG owns a third of the team. Ultimately, I'm negotiating for a slice of this team. And Ferrari would never give you that. I think that there's more at stake here and there's more at play in terms of the contract negotiations than is simply a salary. I think a lifetime ambassador role and I think an ownership stake in the team is something that's probably being negotiated. He would never get that at Ferrari. And I was thinking about this earlier today because I knew we were going to talk about this. And I thought, well, it makes sense that he would still have a conversation with Ferrari. And years and years and years ago, when I was in a job, I was approached by somebody from a different company. And he was trying to recruit me. And he basically said, like, look, Mark, you may not be shopping for a new coat, but it doesn't hurt to go out to the mall every now and then and try some new coats on because maybe you're going to find something that you like. And his point was ultimately, don't be so comfortable in your job that you assume there's no other fits out there. And I think typically, it would make sense for Lewis Hamilton to entertain offers from other teams because it builds up your leverage in contract negotiations. But I think that would ultimately create more friction than it would help produce an abundance of leverage in these negotiations. That's how deep and entrenched the relationship is with Mercedes. But it was a very, very clickbaity topic. And I got very upset with a lot of news publications that ran with this as if it was anything meaningful. Like, who's reporting this? What are your sources? What are your quotes? Was there a conversation? Maybe. Was it meaningful enough that you needed to run a story? No, it wasn't. So here we are.
You know, I mean, maybe Ferrari's a little bit closer than we think. I mean, at least what we've seen over the past couple of years, that it still obviously seems to be a bit of work and at times seems to be a little bit sloppy and disorganized. And I don't think there's anything, you know, that can really to be disputed about that. But I mean, at the stage Lewis is at in his career, he doesn't need the money. I mean, he's already accrued generational wealth. I mean, he's got so many records. I mean, to me, I mean, if I look back in 10 or 20 years on Lewis Hamilton and his career in Formula One, I'm going to think, first of all, Mercedes, and I'm going to think McLaren when he broke into the sport. Ferrari, and this is not, you know, intended to be disrespectful, it'd be like the Washington Wizards years for MJ, right? You know, that's the immediate vibe that I got. And like you said, that this was just a clickbaity kind of thing. And I really don't see any reason for him to go. But, you know, I just want to follow this up with a little bit of an anecdote, because I just, just mentioned that, I would think, in order of precedence, the Mercedes years, then McLaren, and then, possibly something else, however unlikely that seems. But we were in Japan in 2007, and at that time in Tokyo, there were billboards and posters of Lewis everywhere. And I can't remember now if it was for Hugo Boss or Tag Heuer. It was one of the two, some of those, those long time kind of like those brands that are almost very synonymous with McLaren. But it was really interesting, because I mean, this was, when Lewis was first breaking into Formula One, he hadn't really established a name for himself. I mean, he was obvious right from the bat that this guy was an incredibly talented, driver. And, here we are almost 20 years later, well, 15 years later, I guess, whatever it is, a little bit more, and he's accomplished all these things. But it was pretty cool to see, even at that point, because, my wife and I made the comments at the time, oh, look at all the branding, all the advertising for Lewis and Formula, and that's really cool, because, we don't see that at home. We still don't, but it was very cool to see all that time ago. I wanted to just talk quickly about this one here. This is a story from Jonathan Noble over Motorsport.com. Jonathan's just talking about why, Mercedes improving and expanding their campus is such an important thing, and almost getting like that Silicon Valley style vibe to their campus. So they've committed £70 million in upgrading their facilities since 2017, and now Mercedes has given the biggest the green light to their biggest overhaul of their campus. It's going to be finished by the end of 2025. It's going to make their campus more pedestrian friendly. There'll be new construction of marketing buildings, leisure facilities, restaurants, and all sorts of things to help improve the team's working environment. Toto Wolff says that he says he doesn't want it to be just the best factory in Formula One, but this is something that they want to rival the best that even Silicon Valley and the big tech companies can put up. Anyways, Toto told Jonathan Noble in an exclusive interview with Motorsport.com, quote, "We are not orientating ourselves towards competitors in our sport. We are orientating ourselves towards the best technology campuses that we know from the United States. That's the ambition," end quote. So very cool to see. And, more reassuringly, that to me, this just signals that this is a team that is obviously committed to Formula One for the long, long, long term. So I think that's very, very cool. Okay. Excuse me. I'll probably let you talk about this one so I can take a bit of a breather, grab a drink of water. But anyways, Red Bull apparently is going to sell AlphaTauri before 2026 and the changeover, because that whole brand, that team, no longer has any relevance to their brand, to their company. So Mark, this is something, how long have we been ranting on about this now?
Too long. So let me establish the timeline this week, because the story kind of flip-flops a little bit. But on May 23rd, Oliver Hardin over at planetf1.com wrote an article called "Red Bull Will Sell AlphaTauri Before F1 2026, Brand Has No Relevance." Now, if you dig into the article, the entire genesis of this work is quotes from F1, quote unquote, F1 business expert Mark Gallagher. And according to Mark Gallagher, and I'll pull up a quote here, he believes that AlphaTauri in its current state offers zero development value to Red Bull, and that ultimately at a valuation of $800 million to $1 billion, it simply makes more sense to sell the team on. And we've heard this, although Helmut Marko responded to it, ultimately indicated that they decided to keep it. So it was interesting this week that this topic resurfaced. Now, another article that popped up on May 24th by Philip Clearin over at motorsport.com is entitled, Red Bull Decides Against AlphaTauri F1 Sale as it finalizes its plans. So we had an article from Planet F1 on Tuesday, indicating that sale was imminent, that the AlphaTauri team had little relevance or value to Red Bull. And then on the 24th, motorsport.com was reporting that actually Red Bull has in fact decided that they wanted to keep the team. So I'm going to quote here, the decision has been made. AlphaTauri will remain fully owned by Red Bull and will continue to be run as a junior team, Red Bull advisor Helmut Marko revealed in a YouTube interview. Furthermore, it looks like they will continue to use the team as a driver development infrastructure, which is the entire reason that they acquired the team 15, 16 years ago, and that it will continue to be powered by the Red Bull Ford powertrain. So yeah, just an interesting flip-floppy story. And you know, I was talking to some of our listeners about this, and we had some spaces this week, and I think people are tired of the story, but I think more than anything, that as we sit here with just 10 teams on the grid and with so much appetite for more teams, yet you have to kind of constantly remember, kind of remind yourself that there might be 10 functional teams. Like in practice, there may be 10 teams on the grid, but in reality, there's only 9 teams that are actually competing for world championship, because AlphaTauri exists for no other reason than to be a feeder team for Red Bull. That's the honest truth. So it's a little bit disappointing. And I think this is one of the things that both the FIA and Liberty should press Red Bull on. But at this state, according to Helmut Marko, Red Bull has no designs to sell this team, despite what Mark Gallagher reported a couple of days ago.
Yeah, it was one of those things that when I read those two stories you threw into the outlines, I'm so confused. Will they? Won't they? It's but yeah, I mean, it from a driver development point of view, and I think that's the sort of the crux, the whole bone of contention that both you and I have with the existence of AlphaTauri. And you nailed it. I thought it was a great point that you made, that AlphaTauri exists solely as a junior development team for Red Bull. It's like essentially a rolling driver academy. So, I mean, they might occasionally get some good finishes. I mean, they've actually won a couple of races in Formula One. Vettel won, was it the Italian Grand Prix or something back in 2008?
Yep.
And then, didn't Max win a race for them or something? I can't remember. No, Max didn't. No, but
Gasly, Pierre Gasly.
Gasly. Yep. That's right. He won at Monza last year as well. And they've had the odd podium here and there. Yeah, of course, Max won his first race with Red Bull at Barcelona in 2016. Anyways, Mark, the next story is an update. Why don't you take this one away? Because that's from Formula One journalist and, you know, someone that both you and I really, really like a lot. That's Jenny Gao, who suffered a stroke several months ago, at the young age of 45, which was just a shocking, shocking story. But Jenny has provided an update on her health, and let us know what's going on.
Yes, some really great quotes here from planetf1.com. And I quote, closing in on the 6 month mark since the medical emergency that was Jenny's stroke, and to mark Stroke Awareness Month, Gao appeared on the BBC One show for a segment in which she and her husband, Jamie Coley, recounted the circumstances of the day on which she suffered her medical emergency. Says Jenny Gao, "This was my life," Gao said, over images showing her hard work in the F1 paddock before Stark switched to images of her lying in a hospital bed. "But then my life changed dramatically. At 45, I suffered a serious stroke. I've spent the last few months learning to walk and, more significantly, to talk again. Just after Christmas, I got sick. It wasn't COVID, but I had a terrible cough. And then my husband, Jamie, found me collapsed in the bathroom. I was trying to call your name and get you to speak to me," said Coley, "and I was just getting nothing back from you. It was the worst moment of my life." He also revealed how the couple's 6-year-old daughter, Isabel, had leaped into action to help her mother, who was very upset. So it seems that her progress is ongoing. She's worked to recover as much of her speech as possible. They've indicated that it's very possible that it may have been a viral cough that ultimately triggered the stroke, although that's particularly rare. And says Jenny Gao, "It was badly affecting my speech and the right side of my body, so I was transferred to a specialist unit in St. George's in London to have my clot removed before any further damage." And the story goes on. ultimately her progress is coming, but I think it's been very, very complex. And I think ultimately, initially, they may not, and of course, they had no accountability or need or requirement to openly express the severity of the stroke. But I think reading through these comments and listening to this BBC interview, you really begin to understand the gravity that was her stroke and just how seriously it had affected her. And, you know, when it happened, I'm thinking, you know, this is somebody that's, she's a staple in the paddock and she's my favorite voice on the Checkered Flag podcast. And she brings a certain type of energy and presence to every interview and every kind of analysis that she's a part of. And it's been heartbreaking that she hasn't been there this year. And I think I misunderstood the severity of the stroke that she'd had and thought, hey, she'll be back on the grid by Monaco. And you know what? Even if she's never back on the grid, but she can find a way to learn to acquire or reacquire a really great quality of life, I think that's all that matters. But yeah, very, very, very sad. But it's great to know that she's making some pretty significant strides. And it sounds like she's made some really, really great progress in terms of being able to re-engage her husband and her family verbally, which is nice to know.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, frighteningly, I mean, for you and I mean, she is in our age group and, you know, and strokes, you know, aren't, you know, a health condition that we typically associate to people in their 40s. So, I mean, when I first heard that she had, you know, fallen so ill and, you know, it was a stroke and it was so serious, I'm just like, my goodness. I mean, you know, out of all the things, I mean, that would be like one of the last things I would expect to hear from someone in this age, in this cohort to have. But, you know, it just goes to prove that it can happen to almost anyone at any time. And, you know, that's the scary thing. But great news to hear that that she's recovering nicely. And like you say, I mean, you know, the quality of life is improving, you know, for herself and her daughter and her husband. And that really is the main thing. So, Mark, let's move on now. Let's close down the show by, you know, talking a little bit more about the upcoming Grand Prix this weekend in Monaco in a little bit more detail. We talked quite a bit off it about it in the opening segment. Before we do that, let's just give a little bit of background. So there have been 79 prior Grand Prix held in Monaco, and the first time was in 1929. The most winningest driver is the one and only Ayrton Senna, who won there 6 times. The most winningest constructor is McLaren with 15 wins there, and that is quite significantly more than a bunch of other teams. Ferrari has 10 wins in Monaco, Mercedes 8, Lotus 7, and Red Bull have 6. So the circuit is 3.34 kilometers or 2.07 miles. Race length is 260.29 kilometers or 161 and 3 quarter miles long. 78 very, very, very long laps. Last year we saw Charles Leclerc on pole. The podium was Sergio Perez winning, Carlos Sainz in second, Max Verstappen in third. The fastest lap was set by Lando Norris, and that was a 114.693. The lap record is actually much faster than that. It is a 112.909, and that was set by Lewis Hamilton in 2021. So, Mark, just a couple other things. So the tire compounds we're going to see here this weekend are the softest in the Pirelli range, the C3 hard, C4 mediums, and the C5 softs. Mark, is there anything else to add to a preview on this weekend, you know, that we haven't said already? I don't know what else. Yeah, okay, yeah, go ahead.
I guess it's probably more about the storylines that will intersect with this race, right? Which is, obviously, we've seen a Red Bull, with the exception of Australia, we've seen a Red Bull 1-2 every single race. So we've seen some pretty dominant Red Bull performances so far this year. So I think one of the things that we can watch for is, does that continue? Does that carry on? Obviously, Fernando Alonso has been absolutely exceptional in that car, claiming podium after podium after podium and significantly outperforming his teammate in Lance Stroll, which probably isn't helpful for Lance Stroll's long-term long-term prospects in that car, although obviously the benefit of your father owning the team is helpful in ensuring that you have that ride for at least a couple more years. And then the other stories would be things like Mercedes, and Mercedes is bringing this not insignificant upgrade, and will it make any difference? Will they be able to get the setup dialed in over the first couple of days to make sure that their race trim is as effective as possible? And then we've seen Ferrari have some reasonably strong qualifying performances this year. Like you said right from the start, if you have a great, great qualifying session and you end up on pole, maybe there's a surprise win to be had at this Grand Prix for a team not named Red Bull. And honestly, I think there's open, honest, frank conversations at this point about whether Red Bull wins every single race this year. And maybe Monaco is where that streak is ultimately snapped and we see something different. So I think for me, it's ultimately going to be less about the race itself, but more about the storylines that you and I have been talking about through the first couple of months of the season and how they intersect with Monaco. And then, of course, after Monaco, we have a really quick turnaround to Barcelona, which of course is one of your favorite races on the calendar. And I think that that should be, although not the best circuit on the calendar, it's definitely refreshing after a weekend in Monaco. But I think that ultimately anything can happen. And I know at least earlier this week, there were forecasts that suggested that we could see some moisture and we could see some rain on the track. And of course, that changes everything. That changes absolutely everything. It could introduce a little bit of chaos. And you know, you introduce a safety car, you bunch up the field, and then you start racing again. There could be contact. Like, there are some crazy things that could happen. So obviously, there's always reasons to tune into a Grand Prix. If there's moisture, there's an added reason to tune in, not because, of course, we're cheering for damage and chaos, but we're cheering for an unpredictable outcome. But yeah, I think for me, it's less about the race, because I'm not particularly thrilled with Monaco as the racetrack is constructed today, but more about, hey, how does this race intersect and play with the storylines that you and I have been talking about for the first few months this year?
That's true. And I should just mention that since 2018, in the four previous races that we've seen there, are actually going back to 2017. So the last five races, we've seen winners from three different teams. We had Seb winning for Ferrari in 2017. Danny Ricciardo won there in 2018. Lewis won there in 2019. 2020 was no Grand Prix there because of COVID. And the last 2 years, we saw Max and Sergio winning for Red Bull. So, you know, we have seen, you know, a little bit of a turnover in, you know, it hasn't been completely predictable. Although I was just looking at a list of winners. So Nico Rosberg won there three times in a row, 2013, 14th, and 15th. Why do I not remember any of those? I'm drawing a complete blank. And then Lewis winning there in 2016, we had, you know, four wins in a row for Mercedes, right? Well, I mean, 2014 is when it really kicked off. 2013, maybe not so much. I mean, that was the last year of the normally aspirated engines, but it could be, you know, interesting. I mean, you know, we've been pretty negative about it. I'd say the best part that I love about watching Monaco over the course of the weekend is you get some fantastic super slow motion shots of these cars going around the circuit, and when you see them like coming as close to those Armco barriers as they do, and sometimes brushing up against them, I mean, you talk about life being a game of inches, and we talk about, you know, that you know, that Formula One and motorsport, just like how precise the drivers are. When you see some of these super slow motion shots and how close they come to these barriers, it is absolutely incredible. And it's sometimes when you see them actually hit those Armco barriers, it's pretty, pretty cool, you know, to watch it. I mean, like you said, we're not really cheering, obviously, for any mayhem and chaos and things like that. But when you see that they do brush these barriers, which, you know, is literally faster than the blink of an eye, and you'll rarely pick up, you know, at full speed, is really quite incredible. So if you're going to tune and watch, you know, look for those, you know, those clips all weekend, because they're going to be pretty cool, and that'll really blow your mind. But before we go, I just wanted to just to remind everybody of the standings. So in the Drivers' World Championship, we have Max Verstappen currently leading the way with 119 points. That is 14 points ahead of his teammate, Sergio Perez, who is 105. Fernando Alonso currently in third with 75. Lewis Hamilton is fourth with 56. And then Carlos Sainz rounds out the top five in the World Championship with 44 points. Over on the constructor side, we have Red Bull racing away with 224 points in the constructors, 102 for Aston Martin, 96 for Mercedes, 78 for Ferrari, and then only 14 points for McLaren. So certainly, you know, lots to play for, lots to race for yet as we move through the season. And Hammy, I think that's about it. You know, I don't really want to make a prediction on this one. I mean, my heart and my mind both say that it's going to be a Red Bull driver winning this weekend. But if we see a little bit of moisture, it could really, you know, throw everything upside down and change it around. So, you know, maybe that wouldn't be a bad thing. Anyways, before we go, just want to remind everyone, if you want to support the show, by all means, the easiest and quickest and best way to do so is head on over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you enjoy podcasts. Leave us a 5-star rating and review, and that really helps us grow the show, and we are much appreciative of everything that we do. And on behalf of myself and Mr. Mark Hamilton, thank you so much for listening. You want to get in touch, please send us an email at scooteryf1pod@gmail.com or send us a tweet at scooteryf1pod. That's it. That's a wrap. We will be back on Sunday night to wrap this one up. And on behalf of myself and Mark Hamilton, enjoy the race, and we'll talk to you again soon. Bye for now.